Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
When it comes to autonomous decision-making, we still want to ensure that our human values are being amplified through this technology. I look at technology as amplifying human intent. So all of this discussion about AGI and artificial superintelligence, I think, misses the more critical point that the underlying human intent is really what the AI is amplifying.
Welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually. One topic AI and Faith has been thinking about a lot is the impact of AI on war and conflict. And here on the pod, we want to dive into these topics as well. Regardless of their complexity, they are critical topics for all of us to think about in the future. So to get started, we're excited to bring this episode that we're calling AI in the News and Current Affairs, Legal Battles, Military Battles, and Ethics. To do that, we have three outstanding guests, all of whom are thought leaders in the space coming from very different perspectives, and they'll help us dig into these important topics. So let's get started. Thank you guys for joining us today. It's a real honor to have all of you on the podcast. And to kick things off, I'm hoping you can each quickly introduce yourselves and tell us what you work on. And Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, thank you very much, Gil. My name is Mark Chenin, and I teach at Seattle University School of Law. And say for about the past 15 years or so, I've been interested in artificial intelligence and issues related to legal responsibility and then the international governance of AI. And so one of my areas has been international law, so I'm keenly interested in the use of international law in governing AI applications.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us. Andrew?
My name's Lieutenant Colonel Andrew DeBerry. That's what it says on my birth certificate. And I am a Lieutenant Colonel in the Reserves at U.S. Cyber Command, but I'm only here in personal capacity. That means that I've been involved in a range of projects, such as introducing responsible AI through the Defense Innovation Unit, now adopted across the DoD and increasingly across the federal government. In parallel to that, I have also studied engineering and then got an MBA and international studies degrees at the Wharton School, and I've worked in big tech in largely public and social sector initiatives, ranging from Microsoft Education to most recently supporting disaster response projects with AI innovations at Google X, alongside starting a couple of companies in secure AI. So I'm really keen to understand how the Catholic and Christian churches can maximize the social impacts of AI, especially in collaboration with industry, and certainly how that shows up in our warfare.
Wonderful. And Vineet?
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Vineet, the co-founder and CEO of Forte. We're a mental fitness benefit that actually helps employers unlock the human potential of all their employees, both developing them as professionals, but also personally. My previous background was I was a human intelligence counterintelligence officer with the U.S. Marines for about 11 years. Deployed to both Iraq and Afghanistan. And then similarly to Andrew, I studied international relations, albeit not at Penn, at University of Cambridge, where I wrote my thesis on terrorism risk assessment. So an interesting approach to the conversation we're about to have today. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you guys for joining us. This is a really wonderful group to talk about this topic. Like I said, is important and complex. And Andrew, I'm hoping you can start us off kind of real broadly. So how do you think about ethics in war, ethics in military? Like, what even is that entire field and what does it include?
I'll highlight some high-level specific phrases for how the government and the DoD looks at this and then generalize what that can mean. But fundamentally, the military follows law for its application of lethal force. So basic Geneva Conventions and more in particular, the laws of war, also called the laws of armed conflict, that require baseline standards such as proportionality, just cause, and using war as a last resort. Based off that, the DoD further has DoD directives, which require certain ways to apply force, and then DoD instructions, which is how to carry out those directives. And then another layer beneath that are joint publications, which are policy documents showcasing how to bring those together. So as an example, let's say we're talking about AI in autonomous decision-making. Any application of that AI still needs to follow international and U.S. law, Within that, I'll go ahead and throw in there's a inherent dilemma here. If the U.S. abides by certain laws and other countries do not, does that put us at inherent disadvantage in terms of national competitiveness? So ethics versus competitiveness, that dilemma still remains there. But if we play that further into the DoD directives and publications, there are specific instructions for how to ensure combatants are being addressed the right way and civilians are being protected. And so those are captured inside of some of these DoD directives and instructions. And then lastly, the joint publications will advocate that any lethal decisions need to have a human in the loop and human oversight. That is not at the level of law, that is doctrine and recommendations. And so there also it enters some ambiguity if, let's say, some solution might make lethal decisions easier, but at what point does the human need to come into the loop? And then how might we press some common standard? This has certainly come up in the Gaza-Hamas conflict and some projects that Israel's been using, like Project Lavender. So, but at a high level, the U.S. very fundamentally strongly endorses international law.
Yeah, amazing. This is a great beginning. And I love that you already brought up the concept of inherent disadvantage, which of course is something we'll have to talk about with AI and development of AI weapons and whatnot. But before we get there, let's stick at a high level. And Vineet, I want to bring you into this conversation as well. And to really try to ask, like, same question, what is ethics of war, ethics of military? And for someone who's actually been on the ground, where does that come into what you actually did when you were in a place like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, the experts here on this in this conversation are probably Mark and Andrew at the high level. I mean, at the tactical level, the questions that I have are around who's accountable and who's responsible. You know, the questions around the things that we're talking about here are, Lord willing, made by decision makers on the Hill, but also our combatant commanders, et cetera. But the sergeant or the lance corporal or the lieutenant who's got to make these decisions under uncertainty is really where the pointy end of the spear really hits. And the question is, well, who's fundamentally going to ask the question, who's accountable for that decision that we made? And there is a question around the advantage that Andrew just spoke about, which is what we want for all U.S. personnel, I would probably suppose. But the question is at the end of the day, when we're quarterbacking a decision by that lieutenant or that sergeant, is what's a fair way to deal with that person? When they're making that decision in a split second, given the feeds they've received, how would we want to actually articulate the manner in which we would judge that decision that person has made? That's actually the question I would have as a tactical person is, how does my sergeant or corporal or lieutenant actually have to now deal with the consequences they're in about the decision they just made under duress? I don't have a lot of answers to that question. I think I have more questions than I do have answers on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is critical stuff. And then Mark, bringing into the conversation, similar question, what is the ethics of war and military? And then specifically bringing your kind of legal mind, what are we optimizing for? Like, why do we even think about these? Why do we not just think about quote unquote winning?
First of all, I wanted to respond to a comment that Vineet made, because I think it's critical, is that I think the overarching question regarding the use of, say, lethal autonomous weapons is who's going to be responsible when something goes wrong. And I think that debate is out on that, as folks in this circle are probably aware, and Andrew already has referred us to those. You know, there is the law of war, which requires distinguishing between civilians and armed combatants, proportionality that Andrew mentioned. But then, as Vineet says, how do those things actually operate on the ground? And then at that level, I think really it's still debatable as to whether the existing law of war is going to be able to address the kinds of situations we need, I think you're contemplating. Because, you know, the people in this room know that, you know, there is, command responsibility, for example, and there are the laws of war. I mean, and there are war crimes that purportedly address certainly human soldiers engaged in wrongful acts vis-a-vis civilians, for example. But then when you start to bring, an autonomous device into play, then the question becomes, well, is the linkage between the human soldier and that device, the autonomous weapon, for example, is it removed enough so that the human is now relieved of responsibility, even though we all understand that at bottom, we want to have a human in the loop, but given the realities of warfare, it's becoming increasingly clear that, you know, sometimes having a human in the loop might be inefficient in some ways.
Yeah, and this makes me think, you know, as I was preparing for this conversation, you know, a concept that I was introduced to was command intent as opposed to command and control, which is as an outsider, something I'd thought about in the past, and thinking a lot about, well, who gets to interpret when we bring AI and autonomous weapons into that, what the command's intent is. Not to say that humans don't misinterpret things as well, but it really resonated with what you said there. Now, before we dive a little deeper, I do want to bring religion into this. And I think it was Andrew and I, so we'll start with you, Andrew. In our conversation before this, we talked about loyalty or adherence to your faith or to God and how that might come into conflict with adherence to orders or the law or whatever. What do you think about that? Help us frame that thought process.
I'll say at the individual level, certainly your allegiance to God is superior to any other allegiance they have. So there's that. But the second thing I'll fast follow with is that at least in U.S. law, very much aligns and supports that. So let's say in the Catholic tradition or in the Christian tradition, there is just war theory, and that has these criteria that are now very consistent with what is now baked into the laws of armed conflict or the laws of war for international law. And so it's very good that this thousands of years of reflection and intellectual and moral thought have been coded inside of these laws and this pluralistic marketplace, which we continue to evangelize and advocate a position for. So there is helpfulness there. And that said, I mean, we know that our Lord loves to invite us to continuous discernment and challenges. And just because there's some rule out there certainly does not absolve us from continuous reflection. And even when I was deployed and seeing lethal force being applied, it was still my inherent duty and responsibility to think about and pray about the consequences of our actions beyond what my specific job duties and uniform required. And so there is a spirit of always wanting peace, always wanting goodness for yourself and for your quote unquote neighbor or even your enemy. And just as you described commander's intent, there should be a person's faithful intent that keeps them thinking through how to live out that faith more and more authentically as well.
Yeah, I think about that always from the Jewish perspective. And in the Torah, it says something, or I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, that you're not supposed to take delight even in the suffering of your enemies. And thinking a lot about like conflicts that are happening in the world, like how do we find a way to do what we believe is right to protect ourselves, our people, whatever, but not delight in the suffering of others. And I think that's a really difficult kind of conflict. Mark, I want to bring you back into this as well. How do you think about the potential conflict between law and religion, or maybe conflict is too binary, but how you merge those together to come up with an optimal way to operate in the world?
Well, I certainly agree with Andrew that particularly in the Christian tradition, our ultimate allegiance is to God. And so sometimes that will mean making decisions that run counter, say, to the decisions of a government, or in the case of a military, of a commanding officer, because again, that is our first allegiance. Folks are probably well aware, though, that you know there's a lot of, you know, and this is, we're talking about a very deep theological tradition where Christians have tried to wrestle with the relationship between, you know, faith and the state, what the role of the state is. And we just don't have time for that more extended conversation. But all that said is that sometimes, you know, there is a strand of Christian thought which argues that, you know, governments, et cetera, are established or willed by God, if you want to call it that. And so that obedience is actually a good thing in many cases. But in my view, I think that you can take that too far. And then I just return to our ultimate allegiance is to God.
Yeah, absolutely. And Vineet, I want to bring you back into this and add one more element to the conversation as well, which is AI making this conflict or this potential conflict worse? Is it making it easier? No impact? How do you think about that?
War is terrible just by every objective measure. So let's just start there. There's just gradients of terrible that we're talking about. You know, is making warfare easier, is that a good thing? Is that a normally good thing or a bad thing? I'm not a philosopher here, but I'll pretend to be one. That's a tricky question in and of itself. So I don't even know how to answer the question. What AI will certainly do will give you the veneer of objectivity and increase the level of efficiency to a certain degree that could be in some ways, if appropriately applied, be a good thing, but also could be argued in some ways that it was a bad thing. So if we go back to technology several generations before or decades before, the atomic bomb and the use of that kind of force is in some ways a good thought process here to think about. In some ways, it made the warfare much more efficient and effective. But one could very easily argue on the other side that it was a terrible outcome for hundreds of thousands of people that are still suffering to a certain degree from the fallout of that. So I don't know how to answer your question because there isn't a superficial or easy answer to your question. I would just want to go back to what some of the gentlemen here talked about earlier, which is, you know, there is an independent agency that I think, particularly with the lens of our faith, that we never give up. Whether you're the Jewish worldview or the Christian worldview, et cetera, you still have an independent agency about you made in God's image that you cannot be stripped of your own accord. So in the military lexicon, there could be something like the conscientious objector that might have agreed normatively to go into a warfare and then having received orders from their superiors that actually have now predisposed themselves to no longer be in alignment with those orders. There's repercussions for that, but that is still something that is inherently limited to that individual to make that decision. So I think there's ways to be able to always try to reconcile what you believe to be true in your heart about the God you serve and the orders that you are legally obligated to follow in combat. So I think there's still a way to ameliorate just war theory and your own faith tradition.
You know, Andrew said earlier that much of this tradition has been baked into the law of war. And so it reminds me of one aspect of the Nuremberg trials, for example. You know, there was the following orders defense that was raised there. And, you know, folks understand that in certain situations, it is enormously costly to disobey. And yet the tribunal said, we totally understand that that is the case, but that does not absolve the individual from responsibility for following an order they know to be, you know, to be a crime.
There's consequences of either decision, right? If you go to conflict and you decide to go into war with your team, et cetera, you might pay the ultimate cost, which is your life. And so there's consequences of whatever decision you make. And if you decide to be a conscientious objector, as in this case, there's, I don't know if the ramifications are going to be light in that regard either. And just going back to the biblical worldview, there's plenty of examples, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, about how warfare was used in the narrative of God has told us, but also that we are supposed to be submissive to authority as well. So to Mark's point, though, any one of those examples cherry-picked and then taken to an extreme can lend you to a bad spot as well. So I'm saying both sides there. I think there's ways to be able to apply the Christian worldview in this particular sense and to be able to apply just war theory and conflict, just knowing that there are consequences therein.
Yeah, absolutely. Made me think about something I was planning on bringing up maybe later in the conversation, but it's the idea of this concept of like, if there's some sort of moral equivalency when someone is not putting their own life at risk, right? Use the example, if you go in as a team and, you know, at the end of the day, everyone there could pay the ultimate price. But, you know, I always use the example of drone fighters who might be in a basement in Arizona operating drones across the world. And some people felt like there was some sort of moral difference between the pilot being in Arizona and the pilot being in the air in Afghanistan or wherever in the world the operation is. And I'm curious, just because you brought it up, if you have a perspective of if there's a moral difference between the two or not.
Yeah, this is actually something that I candidly struggle with. It's hard to differentiate or separate the hazard of being boots on the ground and then those who are not necessarily boots on the ground. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if we step back even further, and I'm not trying to not answer your question, I'm actually trying to say that actually war is fundamentally a continuation of politics by other means. And so the question is actually, it starts at least normatively, at least process-wise in the U.S. from the Hill. And how do we actually decide whether we go into war or not, if we're in war or not? I mean, this is probably particularly Mark's level of expertise, but like there's some declaration of war or theory, there is a declaration of war and then everything falls out. So the conversation about the individual in wherever in the United States, let's say, and the drone that's dropping that bomb in Iraq and Afghanistan, I struggle with that from a, gosh, this feels like a pretty ridiculous thing to happen. At the same time, I benefit from those things from happening as well. So I'm going to maybe defer to my colleagues here on maybe they have better formed thoughts, nuanced thoughts about how they would answer that.
I'm going to bring Andrew to the same question, but I want to add kind of the next element, Andrew, as you come into this, which is around autonomous decision-making more broadly. And what can our faith and our ethical traditions teach us about when autonomous decision-making might be appropriate and when obviously we might not be appropriate? Any thoughts around that?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, there's a lot of discussion about so many new things with AI, but really it's an opportunity to reemphasize the enduring human values that many of our faith traditions have had for thousands of years and just articulating it with new language. So I think there's a lot of momentum that we already have. So applying some of those long-term concepts to this new domain, and we'll have to do the same thing once quantum comes along and once nuclear power becomes more scalable and whatnot. But when it comes to autonomous decision-making, we still want to ensure that our human values are being amplified through this technology. I look at technology as amplifying human intent. So all of this discussion about AGI and artificial superintelligence, I think, misses the more critical point that the underlying human intent is really what the AI is amplifying. And so when there's autonomy in that decision-making or not, I think the bigger concern to name it is, what is the underlying intent that that AI is accelerating? If it is making it more efficient to execute an operation or execute a task, then there's some inherent good to that. But the faith would ask us to discern what the impact is of that underlying task. So whether it is making farming more efficient or doing your laundry or identifying a payload for a potential strike, and it makes it more efficient and potentially reduces lethality because it's more efficient and fewer people die because it is more efficient, then perhaps there's some good there. But at the same time, if there isn't this oversight, if there isn't evaluation, then that misses the mark for accelerating the goodness and the human intent behind it. So I think we just need to ensure that in the unique dynamics of AI and how quickly a runaway algorithm can just do actions that we don't fully understand, it's not fully transparent yet, despite the EU AI Act pressing accountability for more transparency on these emergent properties, it's still not there today. And so we should reflect on that when we're identifying, well, who then becomes accountable for these nice sounding ideas and these nice sounding principles, when the reality is, because the transparency is still blurry, the accountability is even blurrier, then if we layer on top autonomous decision making on top of that, well, now we've got a really complex environment that the front edge of the law field is trying to address. So, but in our faith, we should keep leading with what values does all of this accelerate into this global environment.
Outstanding. And then Mark, I want to bring you into this as well, but maybe focus you on court. How do you think about autonomous decision-making in the legal arena? And is there anything from our faith or from our ethical tradition that would guide us in one direction versus another?
My sense, again, informed by the tradition, is that, and let me just say that, again, there are other ways of framing this, even from a Christian framework, but I firmly believe that law is, the purpose of law is to be in service of human beings. It's created for us, not we for them, for the law in that sense. And so apropos to Andrew's point, if we find ourselves, if autonomous systems of any kind are harming human beings, then something's wrong with that picture, and then we need to respond to it in some way or another. And the law, provides frameworks, obviously, for us to be able to assess that level, because in a sense, law becomes a way of sort of divvying responsibility to Vineet's earlier point and questions. And then if it's not doing a good job of that, then we have to talk about the ways in which law needs to evolve or change so that it can more adequately address those situations. I did want to point out in response to something that Vineet was saying, and also what Andrew is saying as well, is because this was raised in connection with your question, Gil, about, well, what about the person housed, in North America directing drones? I don't have an answer to that either, but I wanted to point out that, at least in my view, I think the two intellectually sort of defensible positions from the Christian faith are either just war theory, as we're discussing, and pacifism. And obviously the two are in tension. And I'm really sorry, I forgot the name of this author, the scholar, but she points out that, in the early church, there was a strong tradition of pacifism. So much so that, right, that the church was persecuted for that. But at the same time, there were participants, there were soldiers that were Christians. But the point I wanted to make, and this book makes, is that there was a recognition that participation in warfare does something to the individual. So that at least in medieval times, according to this book, Christian soldiers who participated in battles often went then on pilgrimages or to retreats, because out of a sense that their participation had done something to them such that they needed time to go away and reflect and, in a sense, recover from their participation in that very difficult, in warfare. I do really want to highlight the fact that this stuff affects us all as individuals, as people, particularly those who are involved in combat.
It reminds me what you mentioned there of some of the soul searching that the global Jewish community had to do after the Holocaust. And for much of, 2000 years in Europe, Jews often had this philosophy of kind of not being overly involved in government and certainly not having their own governments or their own militaries, largely because they couldn't, but also they ended up building philosophies around that. And after the Holocaust, coming up with whole new philosophies that some Jews have adopted around how do you interpret the Torah and how do you interpret in a way that doesn't allow for another Holocaust to happen? And to your point, searching within religion about the changing times, I think is a really complicated element of this. Now, I want to bring another kind of element into this conversation. And we'll start with you again, Andrew, is around using AI and technology to reduce the number of bullets or bombs we use. I was fortunate a little more than a year ago to be invited by the U.S. Special Forces to an AI symposium that they hosted. I believe it was in North Carolina. And one of the things that I found really exciting is that the general who was running it had this philosophy that said, if we can give our operators different tools other than a gun or a bomb that they can deploy in a mission, then we'll reduce the number of bombs and weapons and bullets that we shoot every year. And to me, that was very optimistic. So I guess my question is, have you seen ways or can you imagine ways that we use AI or other technologies to reduce the amount of lethal force our operators are utilizing? Or is that at this point not really something you see directly correlating with one another?
Absolutely. I mean, that is practically the hope, is that you make the war mechanism more efficient to accomplish the objectives. And so in my time deployed downrange, it was helpful to have some initial uses of AI and computer vision to identify objects. And then that made it easier to streamline what was a legitimate target or what might have been a holy site. And so what's not to like about that? The problem, though, and that's been highlighted earlier by Mark, is when things go awry, where does the accountability sit and how much testing is there of that? And so if you misidentify certain sites and there's ambiguity, then what do you do? There's still a lot of political, cultural influences in what an AI might label or not label and how that is interpreted. And so, I mean, even if it's some of the conflicts that are happening now, if a certain site happens to be an underground coordination point, but it's buried beneath site of non-combatants or a hospital, well, goodness, like, and then the AI recommends an action and then the human says, yep, I accept. Well, goodness, well, what do you do there? We can look back at previous administrations where we used the promise of more efficient tools and more precise strikes and see where they got it wrong. And unfortunately, hundreds and thousands of civilians over time being killed. And so, yeah, the promise of more efficient special operations is great. We certainly don't want to go back to a time where we're pouring boiling oil over each other and whatnot. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the direction we want to head either. But I do think we just want to be honest about what the technologies and the promise of precise warfare is still not able to accomplish today.
Yeah, and Vineet, what's your take on that? Anything you've seen out there where technology AI is successfully used to reduce lethal force? Or is that something you think we're still a bit away from?
I've been out for a long time, so I can't pretend to say that I actually understand how this is being beneficial to the current operators in the zone. But you can imagine how this is like particularly helpful when it comes to, for example, where would the IEDs be planted, and how do we actually evaluate the risks of a certain path over the other by doing regressions on certain MSRs and all the things, right? So that computational power is a certain advantage to us collectively, right? I think there's a real opportunity there to be able to leverage AI in those kinds of ways. The thing that gives me pause is across the kill chain, though, at some point there are one-way doors. You can't undo a launching of a sequence, and that's difficult. And so when you think about, hey, what's the normative right position to take here? Should we have an autonomous AI agent to help us make those decisions if they're one-way doors? I think that's the question that I struggle with more than anything else. It isn't about, I think everyone who's even remotely used ChatGPT or Perplexity or in our just everyday lives recognize the computational power of these tools. And it takes what could take 10 hours to build a discounted cash flow statement. It takes 15 minutes. I mean, like if you're, this is a pretty powerful tool set, that's great, but that's not a one-way door. That's a two-way door. You can undo the model. You can change the assumptions. You can do all the things. It's not like that in warfare, right? Unfortunately, it's like, hey, you make a decision typically under 1 second or a split second, and then you have to deal with the consequences. And so when you have AI helping you make those decisions, we have to recognize that's a one-way door typically. You can't undo it. And there are real consequences to it. And the second thing is the transparency in which that decision-making was enhanced. So there is like this seeming level of objectivity of AI doing its thing, but we all have experienced hallucinations just in the simple things that when we use ChatGPT and Perplexity, imagine, you know, you're having a RAG and you're having all these inputs put in there and it's trying to do the thing. And you're like, how did it come to the conclusion that we should press the strike button? And we don't have the luxury of being able to say, well, which heuristics did it apply for this part of the RAG that actually did this thing? And now we got this answer. That's where I think it causes for more intentional conversation about how to apply it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, I mean, such a complicated topic, and I'm so grateful to have all of you guys exploring it with us. So I want to go back to something that I think Mark mentioned at the beginning of the conversation around like accountability or responsibility. And when we use AI, you know, like it's very easy with any tool, it's very easy for us to lose responsibility, right? The example I always use is my house is not in Google Maps. And that means that every time I get a DoorDash or an Uber or whatever, they go to the neighbor's house. And every single time I message them in the app before they get here, say, hey, we're not on the map. Just pay attention. When you get close, you'll see a big rock with our address on it. And that works 0% of the time. Because as soon as someone's automated the decision-making to Google Maps, their brain is off. They're thinking about work or life or whatever the heck they're thinking about in the car. And I guess that's one of my concerns is that in human nature, when we have a tool, we are just going to default to that tool. So I guess my question to start with you, Mark, and we'll go around and give everyone a chance to share is like, how do we think about accountability and responsibility? And how do we think about setting up, whether it's from things we learn from religion or from law, or from ethics, systems that allow us to make sure that we don't give our agency or our authority to these other tools when we shouldn't? And I know it's a hard question, but Mark, any thoughts around that?
Yeah, that is a very hard question, Gil. You know, at the end of the day, I'll say I'm still asking that question. All of us are, right? A couple of things come to mind. I do think that the consensus still is that ultimately a human will be responsible. But I'm quick to say that our usual conceptions of responsibility, the way we hold people responsible, usually because we're culpable in some way, either we intend something, you know, apropos to Andrew's earlier comment, or we're reckless about something as individuals. But that starts to get strained a lot, right? When say an autonomous device or system sort of interposes itself between the human individual and the person who's hurt by that autonomous system, many of us, myself included, you know, tend to shirk responsibility. So, you know, if something does go wrong, I'm going to try very hard to sort of remove myself from as the cause of that injury, for example. And it will be very easy to say, well, it's the autonomous device or system that's responsible. But then, of course, that means nothing because the system, as it were, capable of taking or assuming responsibility. So,
yeah, building on that, I think it's a wonderful question from industry perspective for the human-computer interaction and the design of the user experience. And so in order to keep the AI from just spitting out an answer that's copy and pasted, there's more models that are building themselves around a more interactive style with the human being. So, for example, OpenAI launching its teach and learn method where it has back and forth Socratic questions. There's different approaches of RLHF where they're asking for feedback as they go along. This dovetails what already happens within coding and Copilot. Like it recommends suggestions and the person has to work alongside it and with it to bring about the next level of the adventure. And so if the human is engaged with the AI in a more interactive way during that customer journey, then that could also invite more accountability and responsibility for each of those steps as well, so that the accountability isn't simply the beginning and the end product, but it is inherent throughout the process as well. So I think the user design community can have some innovative approaches to answer this question as well.
Amazing. And Vineet, how do you think about accountability or responsibility, and how can you draw on your faith or other ethical traditions to do that?
I'm going to do the same thing that Mark said, which is this is a tremendously difficult question. I think that if we go back to first principles for a second, and we think about what is war at the end of the day, it's politics by other means. There is a chain of responsibility and account that starts for a while by elected officials that bring us to commanders all the way down to the person or persons affecting that policy. At the tactical level, it is very difficult in my mind's eye to be able to say that, how do you actually decide who's ultimately accountable? Given the current construct, what Andrew suggested is an amazing idea, which is using ChatGPT or whatever the versions are now, and being able to ask follow-on questions to be able to understand and interrogate the what was even illuminated or brought up to the user. As a user myself, I ask, show me the data, or show me like what, ask me three challenging questions on why it shouldn't be this way, right? And try to interrogate this data a bit more. And that is from the comfort of our offices here in the US. I think that might be particularly difficult when it's an extremely complex situation, you're exhausted, everything's on the line. You're like, how do you expect a human to do that kind of like thoughtful, nuanced interaction with a piece of machinery? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so what leaves me is, what is reasonable for our expectation of the commander or the decision maker on the ground or the person who's affecting the policy in the situation they're currently in? That's what I want to always make sure that we always are discussing is, you can't Monday quarterback this thing. It's difficult.
Absolutely. Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk about a couple of battles happening in the legal arena. And there's two topics that I feel like come up all the time. One is fair use, IP ownership, and basically what is protected and what can AI do as it wishes with. And the second is a lot of questions around identity, likeness, all those kinds of things that come together. And there's a really interesting new law, a new Danish law that passed about IP ownership, or it gives every citizen and resident in the country ownership over their own likeness, over their own voice, over their own features, which then takes the question of deep fakes or revenge porn and lots of other negative things that people do out of the question of free speech and into the question of IP protection. And of course, if I own my likeness and you can't use it without my explicit permission. And then, of course, we saw the first summary judgment in the Anthropic first use case, where I thought the judge, and Mark, I want to ask you what your take on this is, I thought the judge tried to be really nuanced in trying to go into detail and figure out really what was fair use for Anthropic to use to train their AI models. These are books and essays and other things that other people have created on the IP rights for. So let's start with you, Mark. Any thoughts around kind of what's happening in the legal arena, bringing both kind of likeness as well as like IP ownership into the conversation? And if you want to add a little bit more with the Anthropic case, I'm sure our audience would love to hear about that too.
Start with the Danish law. So my understanding, by the way, Gil, is that it's still a proposed legislation, which is making its way through the legislative process. And so, you know, to your point, it would give Danish citizens, nationals, a copyright in their image, as well as certain features, their own features. And therefore, others could not use those images, et cetera, without the copyright holder's permission. And then that will trigger EU law, which would then require, through another law, the digital platforms law, that would require, you know, the platforms to remove that infringing material. And my understanding is that it's the first time that copyright law is going to be used to address the problem of deep fakes. And folks are probably well aware that the United States just passed legislation that, which then, you know, criminalizes certain kinds of deepfakes for revenge porn, et cetera. And it gives, I think, the FCC the ability to then seek removal, although platforms are, in about a year from now, are going to be required to have a process whereby folks who are victims of these deepfakes can ask for their removal as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then on the Anthropic side, anything you can add around kind of what, it's only a summary judgment, we want to stress, it's not a final judgment from the court, but ultimately kind of talked about things that you had access to legally that you paid for versus things that are open available on the web. And my question is kind of the broader question, more than just a summary of the findings, is really, how do you think about that? Do you think that we should be regulating this stuff more often, more frequently or faster, I should say? And based, is there anything from your religion or from other ethical traditions that we can draw on? And then I want to bring both Vineet and Andrew into this in the broader sense of looking at your own religious traditions, any other kind of regulations or laws that you think we might be able to draw from those traditions. But we'll start with you, Mark.
I'll respond to your question, Gil, by saying a little bit about the case itself. So as I understand it, having read the opinion, is that, it was a situation where copyright holders in various books were suing Anthropic for copyright infringement. And the way in which Anthropic was using it is in two ways. They were building a large kind of general library from which they were going to use it, that library for very various purposes, including training LLMs. And to populate that library, they used two sources. One was they went to websites that were known to have pirated copies of books. And so they used that as a source of their library. But they also went out and purchased large hard copies books and stripped them and then, fed them in and digitized them essentially. And then that combined library, portions of it were used to train Claude, their large language model. And so the court there finds that with regard to the books that Anthropic purchased to digitize and then to train, that was a fair use under the U.S. Copyright Act, whereas it was not a fair use to use the pirated material for those same purposes. And then to your more general question, right? So what you see is a court trying to strike a balance between a sense of wanting not to stifle, right, the development of these kinds of models and understanding, acknowledging the need for large amounts of data, including written work, to train them. And at the same time, recognizing that we do have this recognition that, you know, authors have a right to have rights in their work to be compensated for them. And then if I sort of step back and think about, so what's my faith perspective on it? You know, I do think when we make stuff and when we create things, we do have legitimate interests in them, a sense that we ought to be compensated for that. Just any fruit of our labor, and if you want to use that language. But at the same time, we don't hoard either. You know, we were intended to benefit others. And so this, we might disagree with the balance that this particular court struck in this decision, but the issue always remains, right? And so we're going to have to come up with mechanisms to try to balance those two.
Standing. Thank you. And Vineet, we'll go to you next. Any thoughts around, based on your, like, the ethics or religious tradition, about regulations or laws that would help us in this coming great commoditization where AI is being integrated into every aspect of our lives?
Yeah, as the not legally trained person in this conversation, I would say that I go back to just like, hey, everyone is made in God's image. And what we're talking about is impinging on the sacredness and the sanctity of that image on everyone, whether they profess or claim that God is God and who he says and who we know him to be. And so there is a real question around, hey, can you just go ahead without the agency of the human that you're making likeness from? And should you go ahead and do that? That might be a leading question, but that's a hard question to not answer. The secondary thing from a legal perspective is that, hey, what we're talking about is applying a legal framework by actors who would theoretically follow the law. But from a terrorism, espionage, sabotage, and subversion perspective, it's actually to our disadvantage to not understand how the opposing force or the opposing forces might leverage our likeness or commander's likeness or politician's likeness to our disadvantage. And so I think that's something that's really critical to understand the future of how we might think about information warfare. And so that's probably the two things that I would want to highlight is just one, what is the Christian worldview and how we think about the image bearers of Christ, who is all of us? And the second thing is, to the point of maybe being disadvantaged in the information warfare perspective on how this might be applied by the opposing side to do us harm.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard in this type of conversation, people bringing up the Cain and Abel story of the idea of deception and hiding one's identity. And I'm not really sure what the right lesson to learn from that story is for AI, but thinking a lot in the United States and obviously in American politics, having a lot of concern about likeness being misused. What about you, Andrew? How do you think about this field?
So when it comes to this broader question of, are there values from faith that could be applied in more regulations? There's four points I'll make there. Number one is, I think there's still an inherent dilemma that is still not resolved by governments and even the Vatican and other strong religious bodies for how do you balance the ethics with national competitiveness? And in that, I could imagine where, like, in from the international relations community, there's two different theories for approaching this kind of dialogue. One is a realism theory, and then the other is an idealism theory. And idealism certainly are the ethics and the values, and we should honor everyone's privacy. But the realism is very much dog eat dog. And in that world, I just wonder if behind the scenes, the administration might have access to models and applications where all guardrails are off. If we sense that we have an adversary that is not following these laws and they are coming after us, then we will also, behind the scenes, take off our guardrails and have a very realistic conversation with that challenger. And so how do you apply ethics in that kind of scenario? Mm-hmm. And that could be just another articulation of the just war theory of, if one actor is not abiding by common values, then are we not obligated to defend ourselves against an unlawful actor in some kind of way? So that dilemma is still out there. Second point I make, what should just be baseline for values in AI is no AI is above the law. And so if human beings are going to be held accountable to COPPA to protect children online, well, certainly AI should not be having inappropriate conversations with those children either. And there should be some kind of accountability for that, be it on the company that may have researched that and shared that, or on the individual that may have jailbroken that model to allow those kinds of results. So That's a piece. A third piece is having more thorough machine learning safety testing. We already have scenarios where if you ask certain kinds of questions that the AI will block you. So that should be a more common, widespread, consistently applied standard. And then a last point is that instead of just regulating and coming at companies, many companies that I've worked with and I've been in are receptive to common good sense measures. And so can we foster more interdisciplinary dialogue and collaboration? For example, could we have a more comprehensive techno-social benchmark that evaluates models, not just on how they're evaluated today on chatbot arena, but on more holistic measures like the downstream impacts on human dignity, community, family integrity? Mm-hmm. Where is that benchmark? And why isn't the regulatory and faithful and industry communities coming together to propose what that can look like in a way that might go a few steps beyond what humanity's last exam does today? So those are some opportunities where our faith has very real opportunity in this historic moment in our country and our faith and our technology and our governments to come together and do that. So those are some areas where I think there's a lot of opportunity for us and for leaders rising the next generation.
That was an absolutely perfect way to finish the conversation. And my addition was going to be AI demasking. You should always know if you're talking to an AI or talking to a human. But I think the final point you made is much more important, which is at the end of the day, if we want to build a world where AI benefits all of us, we need to have as many people from as many backgrounds and experiences involved in this conversation, which of course is one of the things we're trying to do here at AI and Faith. So I am so grateful for all three of you for joining us. Before I let you go, we do have a lightning round question. Three questions. You each have 15 seconds. We're going to start with Mark, go to Andrew, and finish with Vineet. And Mark, your first question goes like this. What is your favorite personal use case for artificial intelligence?
It is to help me come up with lesson plans for my class, in particular, scenarios that I use for legal analysis.
Amazing. Andrew?
I created a virtual formation team where I had seven fictional and factual characters from history come together in a forum, and I throw all kinds of random questions and see how they respond.
That sounds like a good time, Infinite.
I am terrible at making slides and decks, and Gamma solves that problem immediately for me, so thank God for that.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about Gamma. Next question, Mark. What are not enough people talking about in the world of artificial intelligence?
I think people are talking about it, but I do think we need to delve far more deeply into the way children are using this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Andrew?
Something similar is this idea of unlimited techno-optimism and looking at the downstream impacts of AI on our family, our communities, our human integrity, so that the non-technical leaders are shaping the direction of AI, not just these technical leaders that might have just pure market motives.
Absolutely. I would say amen to that. And Vineet?
I think people are starting to talk about it, but the idea that the study, I think that MIT came up with on the implications of using AI on our cognitive abilities and we have formed a device and now that device is forming us and what are the formations that we're having as a human is a worthwhile conversation, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. The co-evolution of Homo sapiens with AI is something I think none of us are really talking about enough. And then last question, Mark, would you want access to an AI priest or pastor?
I would only because it would be simply an interlocutor, not a true advisor.
Yeah, absolutely. Andrew?
As an advisor, we have to be very clear that we don't over-anthropomorphize that to suggest some kind of authority from training. But if it helps synthesize and resurface and accelerate what's out there, great. But we can't over-humanize authorities and presence that only belongs to a human.
Outstanding. And Vineet, final word.
I would not. Data information, AI can really help with that. Knowledge and wisdom is the realm of God and people. And so I'm going to go ahead and leverage people to do what God gave them the ability to do.
Outstanding. I am so grateful to all three of you for joining us. As we all heard, these are difficult conversations with many more questions than answers. But as we said at the conclusion, to build a world that benefits all of us, we all have to be engaged in these conversations. So thank you for joining us. And of course, thank you to all of you in the AI and Faith community for joining us. And we can't wait to see you next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.